What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. Here's what's ahead. The inflation trades are collapsing today. The Fed getting a little more aggressive. We'll tell you what moves to make right now and why it's all happening. And a lot of people have been piling into ESG stocks, but what exactly is an ESG stock? We will try to define it for you. Plus, a star-studded rapid fire, Jessica Alba's stock slide, and Cristiano Ronaldo's soda snub, Dom, she said. Let's start with these markets, though, turning into quite the afternoon. Dom Chu is here with the numbers.
Slowing momentum. I'm not going to move any Coca-Cola bottles aside here on this one. However, I will show you right now that the markets have slowed down fairly significantly. We've moved towards the lows of the session. However, the Dow is down only, and I say only, 245 points. The S&P is still holding above that 4,200 mark, down about 8 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ is a big focus for a lot of traders today. It has been outperforming all day, up more than 1% at one point here. But right now, giving up about half of those gains still, though, 14,112 the last trade there. One of the main propellants of that NASDAQ and technology trade has to do with the semiconductor industry more broadly. This ETF tracks that industry. It's up about 0.75% today, up about 15% year to date. That's keeping it slightly ahead of the overall market. However, there's been a couple of names that are driving this whole thing. It has been AMD, it has been Xilinx, and it has been NVIDIA. Those three stocks are helping to really propel a lot of those gains in semiconductors. They're all up about 4% or more on the trade so far today. So watch those. And then the stock of the days so far, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Regions Financial, and Zions Bancorp. You mentioned that inflation trade maybe unwinding a little bit right now. Well, that means interest rates are lower. These bank stocks are relatively sensitive to that. So as we see interest rates pull back, maybe some of those yield curve dynamics start to show a little bit more tightening with regard to the overall shape of it. Watch the money center banks like these guys and the regionals as well. They're down big in today's trade. A bit of a hangover, if you will, Kelly, from yesterday's Fed meeting and decision.
At the same time, Dom, to echo what David Tepper said this morning, his whole point was that, you know, the Fed should be tapering later this year once the economy is stronger. A strong economy should help the banks more than this change in the yield curve hurts. But we know that, you know, this is the trading pattern that prevails. I was going to ask you, you know, if you would go so far as to tie the NASDAQ outperformance, whether it's the chips or otherwise, to kind of the whole trade in the market today. I mean, it's a little bit of the deflation trade, right? When growth gets scarce, NASDAQ stocks get more attractive. It's a little bit of the stay-at-home trade from last year. I mean, it's no coincidence that it's happening, right?
Or how about just the straight-up valuation concerns, right? Remember during the interest rate rise that we saw earlier this year, the kind of rather steep rise that we saw many of those growth stocks, many of the technology and communication services, media stocks, lose some steam because when it comes to higher interest rates, those change the assumptions for how you value these stocks going forward and what their present value is today. Higher interest rates mean lower valuation. So when interest rates start to back off a little bit, maybe that's a factor, if you will. I mean, there's a lot of them out there about driving some of the valuation trade back to the upside for those growth names. That could be a big dynamic that traders are watching today.
Yeah, very well put. We've talked often about the link between Tesla and the 10-year as a perfect example. Dom, thank you for now, Dom Chu. Let's check on the bond market now, which is becoming the story of the afternoon, with the 10-year yield going back to where it was before the Fed meeting yesterday. There it is at 1.48%. It spiked above 1.5 after the decision. It is back to where we began. Rick Santelli standing by with more on this. What do you make of it, Rick?
You know, Kelly, this doesn't surprise me at all. Yesterday's knee-jerk reaction to the upside or how even the equities acted makes sense. There was a lot of issues with the dot plots that might have made many investors a little surprised that we've pulled some of this forward. But in the really big picture, I think most real fixed income portfolio managers and large institutions understand the notion of really believing that rate hikes aren't coming to 2024 or 23 point them forward. It's about outcomes. And with a heated economy at 7% GDP, most likely you're going to see many of these issues come towards the front much sooner in a time frame. But today in particular, the dollar index being so strong has put downward pressure on commodities. And if you were to put a CRB index or lumber prices or grain prices or gold, especially gold prices, next to the 10-year treasuries, you'll see the correlation there. So as we see some of these inflationary issues moderate to some extent, it is having a soothing effect on interest rates. But that does not mean that there isn't going to be some bite, some residual bite to inflation down the road. We don't know. But what we do know is commodities, whether it's China, whether it is the strong dollar, which of course leads us to the softer commodity prices, we're not exactly sure what the catalyst is, but the relationship between watching the commodity price come down, strong dollar, and lower interest rates is something to pay attention to. And I do believe getting back above 160 is going to be very difficult. So if many of the listeners and viewers use that as a pivot, as we've been talking about for the last 8 weeks, right, it really does keep you on the right side of the 10-year.
So, Rick, let me just follow up with this for a moment. Here's what's so different about this environment. How we've been spending all year basically so far talking about the risk of the taper tantrum, right? You know, back when Bernanke first talked about the taper happening within a few meetings, we saw the 10-year almost double in yield. Again, this was way back in 2014. We've all been talking about what happens when the Fed starts to, you know, make the same kind of remarks. Now, Powell was not close to that yesterday, but it's obviously a hawkish take that the market has walked away from this meeting with. Why is that sending the 10-year lower and not higher? In other words, what is it about the Fed's hawkishness yesterday that's sending bond yields lower as opposed to the kind of hawkishness that would send bond yields up?
Well, first of all, the entire question is predicated that we should put significance to when we look at a screen and see a 157 yield or a 148 yield. And I will continue to contend that looking at a 10-year under 150 or a 10-year at 167, all of those are distorted views. And the dynamics of the logistics of who's buying, who's selling, and how the yield curve, in other words, that five-year yield that Mike Santoli's been talking about has been very firm. Long-dated is more appealing to some of the buyers, especially global buyers. And I think you're going to continue to see this dynamic. As a matter of fact, I think some of the worst curve steepening might be in the rearview mirror.
All right. Rick, thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Rick Santelli standing by for us this afternoon. With stocks pulling back after the Fed raised its inflation forecast for this year, moved up its timeline on hiking rates, my next guest says there are stocks you can buy that will do well in this environment. Joining me now is Kim Forrest. She's the Chief Investment Officer at Boca Capital Partners. Kim, it's great to have you. So before I ask you which stocks, let me ask you what kind of environment. Are we picking stocks for an inflationary environment, for a deflationary environment? I mean, what paradigm are we in now post this decision?
Yes, we are. That's my very short answer, but I think you want more than that. So I think in the short term, we do have inflationary factors. I think the Fed was really explicit in trying to tell us that this is a reopening sort of phenomenon. And guess what? The U.S. is first in reopening, and we're going to go around the world, and each region is probably going to have their own version of the reopening trade, which includes some inflation as well. So, you know, that's just a heads up there. But I think the longer term, and, you know, since I've been in this business, which is 1999, it's been disinflationary. And the two elements that are driving this disinflationary worldwide environment are this: technology, which we know I love, and that was my first career. Mm-hmm. But secondly, globalization. And we can't get rid of either one of these. We can't unwind that. And so we are stuck in this temporary inflationary environment, but the underlayment is disinflationary.
Okay, so that all said, let's boil it down to some stock picks that you think will do well. What names come to mind?
Sure. Well, if you're afraid of inflation, look for names that have good brand recognition, that they can pass along increasing costs to their buyers. So that to me says consumer discretionary, especially since we're all pretty much tired of clothing that we've had probably since 2019, and we didn't buy anything for a while. So I'm looking at companies like VF Corp, which has Vans, the North Face, and Timberland as some of their hallmark brands. And they are very well thought of, and people want to wear them. So that gives them some power.
Fair enough. That's VF Corp. You also have Micron and Xilinx. Explain those in particular. I mean,
yes.
I would imagine maybe that's the same kind of idea here, but, you know, very different part of the market.
Well, it is, but it's the nerd tech market, right? And specifically, it's 5G. We really believe that 5G is in its implementation phase, and that's going to last for years. We like playing the whole idea of a theme for years, not just months. So that's why we love 5G. And Xilinx in particular, and especially, it looks like it's going to be bought by AMD. They got the big thumbs up there today. So, you know, that's good. But they create products that enable, a hardwire to connect to a cell tower.
Yeah.
So that is just going to be used tremendously. And I think AMD did really well in buying that company.
Well, if thinking through inflation and deflation makes your head hurt, you can just think about 5G and pick some maybe yes. secular winners there today. Kim, refreshing to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kim Forrest with Boca Capital Partners. Meantime, it's been a wild ride for Lordstown Motors, the stock down by almost two-thirds since peaking in February. Look at that decline. Writing for Axios, Dan Primack calling Lordstown the quintessential business fiasco after charges of misstated pre-orders and this week's departures of the CEO and CFO. What are the lessons investors should learn from the breakdown of this once buzzy SPAC? Dan Primack is here to talk about that. He is Axios business editor. Dan, I thought you've made some interesting points about the merits of the SPAC model versus the IPO, and would an IPO have caught some of these problems earlier on before they hit the markets?
Maybe. So in general, you'd say yes, right? Because one of the reasons that a lot of companies like to go public via SPAC, or pre-commercialized companies like to go via SPAC, is they can give forward-looking projections out 3 years, 4 years, 5 years without any liability. If you go via a traditional IPO, you can only go out 2 years. After that, you can say something, but if you're wrong about something material, you can get sued for it. So maybe with Lordstown, but the reality, the other piece of Lordstown is its executives, past and present, keep misstating the facts about what's happening within the business.
So, you know, Dan, this story is not over yet. I mean, the new leadership says we can do September. You know, we're gonna show you what we've got. If we're going to run out of cash, we might as well pull out all the stops and see what we can do in the meantime. What do you make of the merits of that approach?
I mean, that's what they said on Tuesday, in a press conference. That said, the company has already walked back some other things they said on Tuesday about having binding orders for their truck today. I mean, today they walked that back, said, well, they're not actually binding orders the way we would all think of binding orders. It's so hard for me to understand this company. You either have an order or you don't have an order. It's a pretty simple thing. I think most businesses can understand it. Lordstown Motors just can't seem to do it. And again, the old CEO and CFO got booted because they misstated stuff about pre-orders. You've now got a new group who just in the last 2 days has screwed up already.
So what happens now for Lordstown? I mean, this was, as you described, a company that we kind of had pinned a whole narrative on. It was, you know, taking over the Shutter GM plan, and it was in the Midwest, and it was going to be the rise of EVs kind of, you know, coming to the rescue of this industry. And I mean, now GM's doing pretty good, right?
Yeah. And look, this is, as you say, this is a company that a lot of people had a lot invested in, both literally and figuratively. Honestly, right now it's September, right? Can they actually roll trucks off the assembly line in September? And do they have enough cash to do it? Because Lordstown first said, we don't have enough money to get there. Then they said, we do have enough money to get there. And maybe there will be some investment in the meantime, but it's hard to think, given what we've seen over the past week or so, that yeah. the company is going to have anybody really come in to give them money, particularly any sort of good term, given the lack of confidence. So really, I think we're kind of going to wait and see. If they can really pull this off from September, great. If they can't, though, this is a company that's really on the edge of not existing anymore and having that facility shuttered yet again.
Quick final question, Dan. Does the SEC need to change the safe harbor issue so that, you know, companies have to be more transparent when they're going public the SPAC way?
Yeah, they should. And I don't think there's even much disagreement on that. The problem is timing. The SEC came out last week with kind of its calendar for when it was going to make changes to various things. And on this one, on SPACs, they said they would come out with a proposed rule next April. And Kelly, you know that when you come out with a rule when you're the SEC, it takes, you know, a couple months at least for comment, and then you get it through. So basically, what they've said to SPACs is, you've got the next year to get whatever you want to bring public. It's free for all for next year.
No, it's amazing. It basically says, you know, hey, while we're working on this, you can more or less party on in the meantime. Maybe it's up to investors now to be a little bit more discerning. Dan, appreciate it. Good to have you. Dan Primack on Lordstown. Coming up, for speaking of Ford and GM, their multi-billion dollar investments in the EV space are really adding up. We're going to bring you the eye-popping numbers and look at why investors aren't getting spooked with both stocks outperforming the S&P this year. Plus, it's not easy grading green. With the increased focus on environmental, social, and corporate governance issues, why is there still no single standard for scoring companies on their ESG performance? We'll explore when we continue in a moment.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Grading companies on their ESG performance is not as straightforward as you might think. Christina Partsenevelis is here with a look at the wild, wild west of ESG ratings.
Which stands for everything sounds great, right? No. There is no standard definition, and yet various rating firms still manage to assign a score to companies on their ESG performance. So money then pours into these stocks that get excellent grades. But the ratings used for ESG indexes are almost comically varied. So let's take a look first at this chart that we're showing on your screen right now. And they compare the ratings between six well-known ESG rating providers like Morningstar, MSCI, Refinitiv. In governance that you could see circled on your screen there, the correlation is practically nil between these providers. So in other words, one ratings firm's opinion is of no guidance at all in guessing what another's will be. So let's look at Walmart, for example. The environmental score can vary also among rating providers. It's high at 0.72 with one, and then the other provider gives it a 0.25, one being the top score. So very different methodologies were used to create the final score in the same year. And many passive fund managers, as well as researchers, argue ESG stocks tend to outperform the market. But there's a new paper I just read. Scientific Beta researchers argue the added value is inflated and that these companies outperform not necessarily because of ESG ratings, but because the companies tend to be more transparent in general and have stronger balance sheets. So all of these research, or all of this research, shows two things. One, that ratings can lead to inconsistent stock performance, and passive investing may not be the best way to encourage good behavior just yet. But a crackdown could be coming, as both the SEC and the UK government said they're looking into better defining green investing and creating industry standards. How long is that going to take? Who knows? How many other countries are going to follow suit? Who knows?
Lots no, but this is questions. Critically important because they've been debating whether to put ESG funds into people's 401ks. And before anybody signs up and puts their life savings into something that is effectively difficult to, you know, hold to any standard, because what you're saying is that there's really no standard of performance. And if you can't measure against that standard, you have no, first of all, few people don't know what the fees are in the first place for paying for this, but you don't know what to measure it against. And you don't even know if that should be the metric of performance, which is why all of this is so interesting to me. You also, environmental, social, and corporate governance may or may not have anything to do with one another. So if a company scores well on governance, but not environmental, is it an ESG stock or not? And finally, the point that you made is so interesting, which is that if there's no agreed standard on ESG, how do we even know if they outperform?
But I think that's a really, really good point. So if you get a score, two companies get a score of 0.7, right? That sounds great. But one company may do really well at lowering their greenhouse gas emissions, while is completely deplorable when it comes to social, the social aspect. Maybe they're hiring child labor or anything like that. Versus another company that really focuses on improving corporate governance. They have a great board. The executive pays low. And they're also working on the social aspect, so anything to do with HR. but they're really polluting the world. And yet they have the exact same score. So for people that are looking into this, especially with ETFs, you've got to take it one step further, which means more work, and look at the subcategories at least to see which ones align with your goals. But even that, the methodologies are not the same for those scores. So it is a really, really tricky industry. It's new. We're trying to narrow it down.
Yeah,
I'm not an ESG expert or anything, but they are trying to narrow it down. And it's still something that's a process. And hopefully governments are going to help to create some definition.
No,
but it's tough.
I take this all as a good sign that there will be some true standards to come out of this. And then the separate issue is whether, I mean, there's companies like Exxon that qualify better than, should a company like Facebook belong? So many questions to still be answered by all this. Christina, thank you. Christina Partsenevelis. The clean energy stocks were some of the most popular trades going into this year. We know they haven't done that well, though. The clean energy ETFs have come crashing down from their highs. The Invesco Solar ETF and the iShares Global Clean Energy ETF, they're both down about 20% since January. The First Trust NASDAQ Clean Edge Green Energy Fund, how about lower by 8%? And in the year of the shortage, The Economist is warning of green bottlenecks and how they could threaten the clean energy business. Let's bring in Vijay Vaithiswaran. He's Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor for The Economist. Vijay, it's good to have you. So is the fundamental problem here that we're trying to transition the world to clean energy quicker than we can actually successfully pull that off?
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you. Yes, there is a bottleneck problem. It's not the one that sometimes you hear. In order to get the clean energy transition moving faster to the scale that, let's say, the International Energy Agency or some of the international agreements envision, we're going to have 4 or 5 or even more times the level of investment in various renewables, electric vehicles, and other technologies. And what we're running up against is a good problem, you can see, in a certain sense, that is the problems of scaling. Shortages of battery metals, for example. We're seeing difficulty siting windmills and other grid infrastructure that's needed for distributed energy bottlenecks. So it's not a shortage of capital, as the previous segment alluded to. There's plenty of ESG money, but it's a question of finding enough targets and scaling up fast enough.
Well, all of that said, you know, there's a line here that says the overwhelming priority must be to catalyze a bigger surge in private investment. So explain that.
There's no problem of market failure here, in my opinion. Some people think, there's a problem with the markets and clean energy. This is really a question where if we had regulations that allowed sensible, faster approvals, for example, for transmission lines, for siting of clean energy projects. At the moment, it can take 10 years. Transmission lines require sometimes even county by county approvals. You get a lot of NIMBYism and various local economic interests and activism clogging it up. And so we don't have a sensible approach the way we did with other big federal projects, the federal highway system, for example, that we were able to build. So we need to get our ducks in a row in terms of dealing with the red tape that gets in the way of some of this transmission and clean energy siting. If we were to get a regulatory framework that also gave a clear policy signal that investments in clean energy would work, would be rewarded in the marketplace, the market will solve this problem. An example would be some kind of carbon price. The Economist has long advocated a carbon tax. Congress is probably not going to pass one, certainly not this year, but some form of clear long-term signal that carbon prices matter, and it can come in some other way than a carbon tax, that would give the market more confidence that these investments are going to pay off.
No, it's a worthy read, you know, a reminder in many ways of a lot of goals that have been sort of conservative goals on the deregulatory front are now being married with this huge push on the left primarily, but now I would say among the general public to go green or to maybe go clean. So there's a lot of strange alliances that are being made in pursuit of these goals. Vijay, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it. It's good to speak with you. Vijay Vaithiswaran of The Economist. Coming up, from search engine to storefront, Google is opening its first brick and mortar store today. We're going to take you inside and explore the tech company's retail ambitions. Plus, this stock is tanking after reporting its first quarterly results as a public company. It's down 30% from its recent IPO. Can its celebrity founder turn it around? Coming up.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Rahel Solomon, and here is your CNBC News update at this hour. The Senate's top Republican is rejecting a voting rights compromise proposal. Senator McConnell says that a plan supported by Senator Manchin still retains the, quote, rotten core of a voting rights bill with broader Democratic support. And on the news tonight, the search for consensus in the Senate on both election laws and infrastructure spending. A new study suggests that the COVID death rate among black patients would have been lower if they had access to the same hospitals as their white peers. Researchers looked at data from more than 44,000 Medicare patients. Simulations found that if black patients were admitted to the same hospitals as white patients, their outcomes would have been about equal. And a small reopening pullback this spring, new federal highway data shows that Americans drove 5% fewer miles in April than they did in March. April mileage, however, is still up 55% from year-ago figures. You're now up to date. Kelly, I'll send it back to you.
Surprising. Rahel, thank you so much. Rahel Solomon, take a look at what's going on in the markets right now. The Dow is down 407 points at the lows, but we've come well off that. We're down just under 200 points at the moment, and the S&P 500 just turned positive. Are they all listening to David Tepper, who said the stock market's going to be just fine? They're trying. We'll see the Nasdaq still leading the way with an 0.8% gain. Here are some of the individual movers this hour. Roblox is trying to stage a rebound from yesterday's 8% drop after it reported a decline in users and their spending. It's fractionally higher, but it's still on pace for its worst week ever, down 11%, and it's set to see back-to-back weekly declines for the first time since its March debut. ARK Invest CEO Kathy Woods is buying the dip, scooping up about $11 million worth of Roblox shares yesterday. You can read more about her moves on CNBC.com/pro. Shares of AMC are moving higher for the fourth time in the past 5 days. They're now nearing their all-time closing high of $62.55 from 2 weeks ago. We're at $61.23 with today's 11% gain. Tonight, tune in to a very special edition of Fast Money as they look at what's driving the price action in AMC and talk to some of the biggest players in the trade. That's tonight at 5 Eastern on Fast Money. And Google's retail play, oil, but make it fashion. And Ronaldo fizzes on Coke. It's all coming up in rapid fire. We're back in a moment. Welcome back, everybody. Whew. Let's catch up on a few stories that should be on your radar. It is time for Rapid Fire, and joining me to break down today's headlines are Deirdre Bosa, Rahel Solomon, and Bob Pisani. Welcome, everybody. First up, this Google store, they're opening their first ever permanent retail location in New York City, aiming to create a space where consumers can come in and buy Pixel phones, Chromebooks, Fitbits, and so forth. They can also get hardware repairs, attend how-to sessions. Now, I like this. You can get help with software products like Chrome or Gmail. Still, guys, this company gets 80% of its revenue from online ads. Deirdre, what is this really about?
It's about experimentation, right? This is just the latest big tech company to experiment with brick and mortar. This is one store. The company can't even say if more are underway. But as you said, Kelly, 80% of revenue is advertising. It is moving deeper into the hardware space. So we've seen a similar move by Amazon, pop-ups and experimenting with retail stores. But that's my read. This is an experiment. It is across the street from an Apple store in Chelsea. So a bit of fun there, too. See who gets more foot traffic. I think it's going to take some time for Google, though.
Rahel?
Yeah, I think to sort of piggyback off of what Deirdre said, experiential, but also, you know, we're seeing retailers really sort of dive into, you know, helping consumers experience their products. We saw it with Lulu opening that massive store in Chicago, I believe it was. And so I think it's interesting. It's a way really for consumers, even though Google doesn't make a ton of money off of hardware, it is a way for consumers that are in Chelsea or in New York City to really get in there and sort of experience how the products work. So I think it's pretty cool. I'm not necessarily a Google person, but I think it's a pretty cool concept.
Rahel, I got news for you. We are all Google people, whether we like it or not. I mean, come on, Gmail, Maps, the thing itself.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I don't know what I'm going in there for, but I still would love to go in. I just think it would be interesting to check it out, Bob, and maybe they got a break on rent.
I think there is less here than meets the eye to this story, and I'll tell you why. You say, oh, it's you know, they sell digital ads. That's what they do, and they're opening a store, a physical store. Isn't that cool? Some new revelation on their part. What's happening in this store? You're going to walk around. You're going to look at their, here's our Google phone. Here is our thermostats. What are they going to do with this information? They're going to digitize it, and they're going to sell you digital ads. You're going to get pop-ups on digital ads based on what you see in the store, and they're going to sell your information. It's the same basic idea the company is using, only now they've got a physical person to walk around and help gather the digital information.
You know, all of that said, Deirdre, I find myself, you know, I was thinking it over as to whether I was going to opt out of this new Apple thing with the iOS upgrade. I've pretty much opted out of every app that's asked me if I want to be tracked across other apps, because how could you not answer that by saying, no, of course I don't want to?
I mean, maybe you like the ads. I love Bob's take, though. It's so cynical, but I like it. You know, they're going to need a lot more foot traffic, though, Bob. They're going to have to open up stores everywhere to make up for some of the privacy changes.
Last word, Bastani.
Wait, me cynical?
What?
Deirdre.
Rapid Fire is only getting started. We've got a lot more time.
No.
Especially if we start talking about The Honest Company, which is having a pretty bad day right now. In its first quarterly report since going public last month, Jessica Alba's health-conscious company reported a smaller-than-expected loss. They beat revenue estimates, but they reported an operating loss of $4.1 million compared with an operating income of $700,000 the previous year. Now, they attributed this performance to increase sales of disinfecting products last year, a little bit of a hangover effect today. And speaking of which, the shares are down about 8.5% right now. They've slid, Rahel, about 30% since their debut. Now, and this has been a rapid fire topic before, you know, where people say Jessica Alba has enough personal star power that she could like move this company to the next level just by using the products out there on social media and creating a follow. I mean, is that going to be enough?
Yeah, you know, I don't even know if that's what it will require, Kelly, only because I think that what the company is based off of, clean ingredients, sustainability, I think that those are also topics that are sort of in vogue right now with consumers. I also think that the stock reaction today might be a little bit of an overreaction. There's only one sell rating, or even hold rating, rather, on the stock. And that's not about the fundamentals. It's more about a lack of catalyst moving forward. So I think Jessica Alba, to your point, Kelly, is certainly a great ambassador for that brand. Mm-hmm. She certainly embodies that clean look. But I think it's already something that we're seeing with skincare brands trying to employ more of anyway, because consumers right now are looking for more clean, more natural looks with makeup. And we hear it sort of across the retailers. We hear it in the Ulta call.
Yeah.
And so I think they've sort of tapped into something that consumers really want right now, regardless of, you know, its star power.
And so, Bob, if that's the case, then is this just, we often see this kind of, a company goes public, a lot of excitement, great narrative, you know, they show up everywhere, the shares are bid higher, and then there's this hangover, especially after the first report. And to Rahel's point, once you get through that point, then you kind of, it feels almost get like the real starting point for how the stock's going to do.
I agree, and I'm going to shock Deirdre and be very sentimental here. I think Jessica Alba should pause. I think her team has done a fabulous job of executing and getting it to this point. This was their first public report. The stock's down. I don't think it's that important, the stock reaction. She has successfully created a brand image. The brand is, let's have children exposed to less toxic products. That is a noble idea. I certainly support the idea. And she's been able to execute. Okay, they're losing money this year. They have a shot at break even next year. It's only $16. This company, compared to some companies we talk about, is a model of corporate propriety. I think it's time to stop, take a bow. Good job, Jessica Alba, and your whole team.
Pisani. All right, Deirdre, you get the last day.
Were you listening, Deirdre?
Yeah. Okay. I love this warmer side of Bob Pisani, I really do, but now I'll play Pisani and I'll look at some cold, hard numbers here. And that is, I got one word, diversification. The Honest Company has done a really good job with this. Nappies, diapers, and wipes, that segment made up 70% of revenue in Q1 of last year. This quarter, just 61%. So that is progress. And to Rahel's point, they're getting more into makeup and household and wellness. So I think when you come, when you look at those numbers, that is a bright spot.
All right. We're going to do a quick mention here of Boot Barn. Fit this one in and then we can talk about what's going on with Coca-Cola. It's an interesting little story. But Boot Barn is getting a buy rating today on rising oil prices. Here's one way, I guess, in which higher oil prices can be a good thing. Citi talking about the correlation between high prices and demand for work clothing for oil workers. Boot Barn trading about 0.5% higher today, but look at this performance. It's more than tripled from its IPO last year alongside the oil price move. So I don't know, Bob, if there's too much to say about this beyond the fact that, you know, there's always a basket of stocks that we always say do well. And they're always like Texas-based companies. This was the whole line on Nordstrom for years. I guess it still holds.
Look, they make great boots. I've been in their stores. I would be very cautious about throwing a lot of money at a company that is primarily tied to the oil and gas industry. I mean, 50% of the sales are cowboy boots that are very much tied to that particular industry. That's a It's a great product, but it's a fairly narrow niche. I'm not saying anything nasty about the country. I'm just stating a fact.
Rahel, go ahead.
Well, Bob, just to sort of, present a different side of that, cowboy boots, this is also not my thing, but cowboy boots are also making a comeback. You see that in the note from one of the analysts saying that, you know, you have Texas rodeo season coming back. And I think it was just 2 days ago that the New York Post did a story about celebrities wearing swimming suits with cowboy boots. So apparently, it's back in style.
Deirdre.
Just saying. You heard it, not here first, but
let me tell you. Trendsetter Josh Lipton, I feel bad that he's not here, has been wearing cowboy boots for years. I don't think they're from Boot Barn. I think he has some upscale ones. So if he's someone to go on, they are making a comeback, Rahel. And let me tell you, I'd never heard of Boot Barn. So I did an Instagram search for hashtag Boot Barn. I did not see one oil and gas worker. I saw 44,000 posts by influencers and a lot of bachelorette parties.
Well, maybe
City. And Bob, for what it's worth, I think you can totally make it work with the suit. Just saying.
With the bathing suit or with the suit I'm wearing on now?
No.
I think I'll stick to my Cole Haans. Thank you very much.
Okay. And we will move along to topic four. Soccer star Cristiano Ronaldo is causing a stir off the pitch at a post-game press conference for a Coca-Cola-sponsored tournament. A Coke-sponsored tournament. Ronaldo moved the soda bottles away from the podium and picked up a water bottle instead. Now, this sent Coke's shares lower. And then Tom Brady piled on, tweeting that, quote, it's almost like the veterans know what they're doing, kind of hinting, of course, Cristiano wouldn't be drinking Coke. Again, this is at a Coke-sponsored tournament. So in a statement, Coca-Cola said, quote, everyone is entitled to their drink preferences. People have different tastes and needs. Players are offered water alongside Coke and Coke Zero Sugar on arrival at our press conferences. Rahel, I mean, it's interesting to me that the stock would even move on this. It can't certainly be news to anybody that, you know, two of the fittest athletes on the planet are not going to be chugging this stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the stock was down like 5% shortly after he did that. I don't think it's a huge surprise, but I did wonder when the news came out if he was making he was making a statement about it.
Sure.
I was wondering, does he have beef with Coke all of a sudden? In any event, yeah, it's not a surprise. Of course, Tom Brady, too, the way he eats and the way he sort of takes care of his body has been well documented, but not a huge surprise. But the way he did it just felt a little dramatic. And so I wondered if there was something there.
Hey, I wonder if he'll have to walk it back, Bob.
Well, here's a very interesting question. On the one hand, this is much ado about nothing. You could say the guy went off the reservation a little bit on corporate endorsements. But on the other hand, he didn't sign an agreement with Coca-Cola to do a global advertising. He is not under some contractual obligation to wave Coke in front of anybody's hands. To your question, though, there may be a non-disparagement clause in his contract that says you can't say anything against the advertisers. I don't think that would rise. This would rise to that. But it is an interesting legal question if you really want to pursue it. I think Coca-Cola will not do that. I think they're much smarter than
Deirdre
that.
Deirdre Bosa will give you the last word on Coca-Cola, Cole Haans, and anything else that's happened in rapid fire today.
And Josh Lipton's boots. No, on the Ronaldo story, all I have to say that as a parent, I was really happy to see this move. My five-year-old is starting to watch soccer or football, and to see, you know, one of the biggest stars push away a sugar-filled drink was probably pretty impactful for a younger generation that's growing up and getting to know these products. So that could be damaging.
The Honest Company might be the next sponsor if the stock does well enough. Guys, thank you all today. Really fun. Deirdre Bosa, Rahel Solomon, and Bob Pisani. And still ahead, shares of women's health company Organon, which was recently spun off from Merck, are down 17%. The company just closed its first acquisition, and with the women's health market projected to grow exponentially in the next few years, we're going to speak with the CEO about where he's seeing opportunity. Again, down 17% since that spinoff. We're back in a moment. Welcome back. Women's health is often overlooked by the pharmaceutical industry, but it's recently garnered more interest and investment. In fact, the global women's health market is projected to reach over $41 billion by 2027. Organon, a women's health company recently spun off from Merck, is well positioned in this nascent industry. Joining us now is our own Meg Terrell for an exclusive interview with Kevin Ali, the CEO of Organon. Meg?
Well, Kelly, thanks so much. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Your first time with us, of course, having just spun off from Merck June 3rd. You know, tell us about the combination of assets that you took from Merck. You've got women's health. You've also got biosimilars and something you're calling established brands, sort of older medicines that didn't make sense for Merck. Tell us why they make sense together for Organon.
Well, it's great to be with you today, Meg. And on behalf of the 9,000 founders of Organon, we're just actually celebrating 2 weeks since our bell ringing ceremony, the New York Stock Exchange. We are going to hit the ground running. This is a women's health focused company in the sense that there are significant unmet needs out there today. And we've got a very vibrant reproductive health business and contraception and fertility. But we also have an opportunity to be an aggregator of women's health assets. To that point, we just announced yesterday and closed on our first deal, which is the Lydia Health acquisition, to really solve the issues around postpartum hemorrhage. It's one of the leading causes of morbidity and mortality of women in terms of childbirth. And so we're very excited about this. But we do have two other businesses, our biosimilars business, which is a growth component for us, and our established brands business, which is a very stable group of products that will continue to provide oxygen to the system so that we can ultimately do some business development and really start to mature the product line.
Well, tell us about the reception from Wall Street. It's only been 2 weeks, but the stock is down. It's really diverged from where you've seen Merck trading since the spinoff. Is this a story, women's health, as an important area and as a growth area, is that a story that's hard to sell to Wall Street?
Well, you know, on the contrary, in all of our discussions with all potential investors out there, as well as analysts, I think everybody believes in the fact that there is a clear need, a time for a women's health company to be born in the world today to address some of these unmet needs. Let's just talk about a few of them, whether it's uterine fibroids, of which 26 million women in the United States today have uterine fibroids, and only 20% of them are actually diagnosed and treated effectively. Menopausal symptoms, of which there is no effective non-hormonal treatments today. Endometriosis, and the list goes on. Postpartum hemorrhage, of which we just made the acquisition of Alydia to help resolve some of those issues. We can be an aggregator of some of those assets. And I truly believe as we start to deliver on our guidance quarter after quarter, and we start to action on some of the business development opportunities we have, people will start to see, investors will start to understand the value in this business going forward. And we believe that the time is right for a company like Organon to be given birth to.
Well, a lot of folks on Wall Street focused on your largest product in women's health, which I believe is Nexplanon, the contraceptive device. You know, sales dropped during the pandemic. What are you expecting in terms of that rebound?
Well, you know, when you look at unintended pregnancy rate in the United States, it's hovering around just north of 40%. It's screaming for innovation in the space of long-term, long-acting reversible contraceptives. Nexplanon is a unique product that was actually growing double digits prior to the pandemic. We see more and more women coming back into the clinic today, wanting to have access to long-acting reversible contraceptives. Nexplanon has patent protection into 2027 with an opportunity to extend it to 2030 in the United States. It's going to be a $1 billion business for us. It's growing. We feel that there's really a lot of momentum behind this innovative, unique opportunity to essentially get your unintended pregnancy rate down with innovation.
Another thing we hear from investors is they want to see or expect to see some major M&A from you guys to kind of kickstart growth. What can you tell us about your plans on that front?
Well, you know, we've done, Meg, to that point, we've done a lot of kind of benchmarking to understand exactly what's out there. We see about 140 assets in various stages of development across the world right now. This is fertile ground for a company like Organon, again, to be an aggregator of some of those assets, one of them being Alydia that was on our list that we acted on. And we're very, very bullish on Alydia with the JADA system. We believe that that is really underrepresented in terms of what we can do throughout the world and pulling it into our organization in the U.S. and then pulling it throughout the world and ultimately making a product like JADA available to the rest of the world, to women who need this. But also when you start to think about all the other assets out there, listen, peak sales of $300-400 million of a given asset may not move the needle for big pharma, but it clearly moves the needle for a company like Organon. There's plenty of those assets out there, but ultimately we are a purpose-driven company. We're going to put women at the center of everything we do. We're going to listen to the issues that are on, and we're agnostic of whether it's a therapeutic intervention or device intervention. We're going to go out there and solve some of these significant unmet needs that have long gone unmet.
All right, Kevin Ali, we appreciate you being with us, and we'll be looking forward to following your story. Thanks again.
It's a pleasure, Meg. Thank you.
And Meg, our thanks to you as well. Still ahead, automakers pouring money into electric vehicles and investors are buying in. But when will the massive spending stop being a positive thing? We'll explore that right after this. Watch out, Tesla. Nearly every automaker is now announcing plans to build battery plants and is pouring money into making electric vehicles. Phil Lebeau is here now with the eye-popping numbers this is all adding up to. Phil?
Kelly, these are eye-popping numbers. They come to us from Alex Partners, a consulting firm which has been tracking not only EV investments here in the U.S., but for automakers around the world. Listen to this. Through 2025, the auto industry is planning to spend $330 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars on EV infrastructure. We're talking about plants, battery plants, component architecture. The EV investments that have been announced in the last year, now totaling $330 billion, that's up 41%. And here's the reason why we're seeing all of this money pouring into building new assembly lines, putting equipment into these plants that will cost billions of dollars. It's because the EV sales are going to be surging over the rest of this decade. In fact, it really ramps up, let's say, 26 to 30. And this is, you know, when you look at U.S. EV sales, you're looking at, what, 25 million vehicles? Most believe you're looking at least 24 to 25% of the EV sales or glow of the auto sales being EVs worldwide. And the number of models for sale that will be electric, it gets ramping up from here. 39, 74, all the way up to 125 by 2025. Today, the automaker Canoo, the electric vehicle automaker Canoo, which has yet to start building the vehicles that it plans to sell over the next several years, has said it's going to put a plant in Pryor, Oklahoma. That is just outside of Tulsa. And also, let's take a look at shares of Ford. Those shares have been moving a little bit today after the company said Q2, it will be better than many people were expecting. But remember, they're going to be cutting their production in half for the quarter, so you're going to see lower net income. Kelly?
Yep, absolutely right, Phil. And a good summary of where all the spending is going, our Phil Lebeau. That does it for The Exchange today.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.